first thing I want you to know about this book is that I have left it intentionally narrow. I wanted to build as simple as possible, and quite simply, have there been arguments against expanding the death penalty, those arguments have included an economic standpoint, where it's expensive to hold continuous appeals to people in death row. This bill doesn't address that. It's not built to address it. I can even envision a way that this would save the state money, because if they're to sentence appropriately, you would avoid the expense of a long trial because they're pleading guilty. You would avoid the cost of having an economic figure. It gives the prosecutor one more tool in order to do his job. Further narrowed in the scope of this bill is the fact that it doesn't compel this penalty. It merely provides the prosecutor with an additional tool to reach for if they decide that the charge is meritful. Murder one, those are the crimes that specifically are covered under this. It's knowingly causing the death. Something you did, you knew. The reason I'm introducing this right now is I spent the last 2 years as a first-term representative in the House watching how bills are produced, watching how they become law. And over that period of time, I also saw a really disturbing trend. There seemed to be always in the paper a news story carrying the death of a child, toddler most of the time, because their parent left them in the care of somebody who demonstrated a lack of regard for human life. In the last 5 years, to reflect on every happy in their life. And because somebody demonstrated a lack of regard for human life, they've taken that away from that child. That child will never get to go through that.
Thank you, sir, for taking my question. Don't we have enhanced penalties that take care of that?
Hopefully there'll be. My opinion is that 12 and 17, you don't have a legal expectation to understand the consequences of your actions. That's why quite frequently 12 and 17-year-olds are treated as minors rather than as adults for a crime.
You feel that someone of that age should be?
Prosecutors don't have a chart.
It's a social psychology check on aggression. And they always would be believed.
All right. I see no other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, call Skip Barron.
That's you in the paper.
Oh, okay.
Everyone in the committee has.
Thank you. Chairman Welsh, and thank you, honorable colleagues. I am, for the record, I am Representative Skip Barron from representing Rockingham 18 and representing the town of Exeter. Before I was a legislator, I was a pediatrician. And as a pediatrician, I specialized in working with children and families when there were injuries which had been inflicted. In this work, I had many occasions to evaluate infants and toddlers who suffered severe head injuries, injuries which were not accidental and often led to permanent brain damage or death. In determining the cause of these injuries, I would spend hours talking with parents and others who had responsibilities for these children. Yes, we would find an adult responsible for inflicting these injuries. And often, it would be the parent. These parents did not intend to kill their children. Rather, it is in an effort to quiet a crying child or otherwise annoying behaviors that these parents would, quote, lose it temporarily, and in a brief moment inflict an injury with a devastating outcome. These people are not monsters, and or a threat to the public. These people may have some impulse controls, but they are not people who are going around killing children. So therefore, I ask you not to pass this.
Amen. Thank you very much for
your testimony.
Thank you. James Sylvester.
I'll be over there in a minute.
Okay, next week your problem.
My name is Jane Sylvester, and I'm for the bill. Reason why I'm for the bill, 2 years ago, my little cousin, he was raped, drugged, his neck broken, his skull crushed, and the guy videotaped it. You tell this little boy, his birthday was November 23rd, 2014. He was murdered November 15th, 2015. We buried him a day before his birthday. The guy's in jail, still hasn't gone to court yet. He raped him. How can you look at this little kid and tell him that his life didn't matter? This guy knew what he was doing. And as for you to say about a 17-year-old, if a 17-year-old is old enough to drive a vehicle, he knows right from wrong, so he knows what murder is. And you're a teacher. You look at the negative, the things that, I can't even think of the word I want to say. I got all upset. I'll tell you after. This is my other friend. This is Kathy Lynn Glotty. She's been on Channel 9 News a lot. We were 13 years old. She was murdered. She was run over by a car. She was dragged by a rope. Her bones were broken. Her vagina was ripped. You tell her why her life isn't meant. These are people that are getting murdered. Yes, there's occasions when people are innocent, and you had said something about a parent getting ugly. I had an ex-husband that beat me. He broke my jaw. He broke my arm. Not once did I ever take it out on my daughter. I worked 10, 12-hour shifts. I went from a secretary to a welder so I could support my daughter. I not once ever, ever laid a hand on my child. People these days, they think they can get free welfare. Everything's easy. Nobody takes responsibility for what they do. See, this is my cousin. This is my friend. And for 45 years, I've lived with her being murdered and the way she did it. And the guy's still walking free. No one's done anything, but this month, ByDoc Society will be coming. I'm sorry I got ugly. I can't remember what I was going to tell you. I got all wound up. I'm not a public speaker. But these are just two cases. Another case, little Elliot kid. He was murdered. He was 8 years old. This was up north. And the kid that murdered him was 16. Stabbed him to death. He buried him underneath the leaf. At the age of 18, his term was up. That was it, because he was underage. So for 2 years, he went to jail, taking someone's child's life because he was mad at him. You just got to stop making punishments that people pay the crime. Drug dealers, you know, if they got capital punishment. The guy in Tilton, he was a coach. He knew that heroin is friggin' addictive. He wasn't on it, but he kept on dealing it so he could line his pocket. So he got rich off drug addicts, and little Seth Fogg Tilton ended up dead. These are different types of murders, and we got to start thinking about, hey, no more. There was 8 babies since September of last year until this year, 8 babies killed. babies that aren't fed, babies that aren't clean. You go in any Walmart, you'll see the mother all dressed up and the kid looks like a piece of crap. No socks, no winter jackets and all that. I work hard. I was a single parent. I did it all. There's no reason why people have to kill other people. And I don't care what age they are. If you can't pull the button, I can. Because I've lived with this all my life. I will be living... Him and I had the same birthday, November 23rd, and he was special to me. And every birthday that I have, he is no longer there, no longer. His grandparents no longer have it. His dad no longer has them. You know, it's just not right. I feel that taking church and state should be different. You know, I can believe in God. But I don't believe God's making my decision about capital punishment. It's you pay for your crime. Again, I'm sorry. I'm just so worked up about this. Any questions?
I think you've covered everything.
Hey, I'm Frank. You're lucky I didn't use my hands.
I see that. Oh, okay, Brad has a question.
Do you want... The pictures? You want to look at them?
Little boy.
Oh. This is Sean Sylvester, Jr.
Oh. The gentleman that is in jail, what is he being charged with, just out of curiosity?
That has been kind of, we're working on that right now. As far as I know, if he doesn't go to court by November this year, he gets to walk free, which won't happen. This is something that Werner and I are working on to see if something like that will end up in a law to protect people that are murdered.
And when did the murder of this little boy happen?
November 2015.
15?
Yep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'm really sorry for your loss.
It's hard. When you see a little casket like that, and he's laying in there with his little teddy bear, because someone can rape him and break his neck and break his skull and videotape it, and that doesn't deserve a death penalty, there's something wrong. Because this little boy will never see kindergarten, first grade, or get married, or have his own kids, you know, to laugh with our family, because our family is a big, big family. Our cousins and all that, always on a Sunday get together, and I can show you videos of our family. He will never be able to come at one of those parties. He will never be able to graduate from high school. He's not going to be able to do anything. I mean, this could have been your grandchild, your child, your niece, your nephew. And capital punishment, people are going to learn. They can't put their hands on other people. You know, abuse is abuse. I mean, can you imagine the pain he went through? He drugged them. He thought, because he was drugged, that he could do that to him, and he wasn't drugged. So he fought, and then he breaks his neck. He crushed his skull because the little boy's fighting him.
I have an oak tree if you need it.
Huh?
I have an oak tree if you need it.
I got a nice one right on Main Street in Franklin, right where everybody can ride by, and I have no problem.
All right.
Any other questions? I can't remember what I was going to tell you.
I think that's it. Well, if we have time at the end of the hearing, and you remember?
I just got wound up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sarah Bludgeon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Sarah Blodgett. I'm the Executive Director of the New Hampshire Judicial Council. The council has not taken a position on this bill. I'm just here to provide some information on cost, and I do have some handouts. <clears throat> Okay. The Judicial Council is the state agency that is responsible for paying for defense services for the indigent accused, and for ensuring the quality and effectiveness of appointed counsel. As I said, the council has not taken a position on this bill, My testimony is limited to the cost of defending a capital murder case. I don't think anybody in this room would argue with how heartbreaking these cases are. And I would also just like to state for the record that despite the fact that my testimony is centered on cost, I am not in any way stating that the appeal process is overly burdensome. It is a constitutional mandate. As most of the committee members, I'm sure, know, the state has one pending death penalty case right now, State versus Michael Addison. That case began in October of 2006 and is still being litigated today. The representation on the underlying cases has cost approximately $2,775,000.
Can you repeat that last number?
Sure, $2,775,000. And that is a very big sum. One of the documents that I provided is a docket list from the trial court that heard the underlying case and the appeal. And I think it's just helpful to look at all of the different steps taken by defense and prosecution in this case to really understand how complex and time-consuming capital litigation is. And for good reason, the stakes have never been higher. Approximately $335,750 of that $2,775,000 was used for services other than counsel. That covers the cost of transcripts, forensic psychiatrists, and other expert services. For each of those services, the court hearing the case reviews the request and approves it prior to authorizing the service. So those have all been approved by a judge hearing the case. In December of 2015, the Hillsborough County Superior Court found Mr. Addison eligible for the assistance of counsel to pursue habeas corpus proceedings in the state court system. A habeas writ allows a defendant to raise many issues that cannot be raised in an appeal, because a writ is not limited to re-arguing points that were raised and lost below. In fact, its main function is to raise issues that are, by definition, outside of the record. In essence, the legal team on the Hague has to review all of the transcripts, all of the court files, the prior counsel's case file, and I've had a chance in my role here, the judicial counsel, to look at the file in that case. It is over 100 banker boxes worth of documentation, and it takes up an entire office with the public defender. Prior to appointing counsel to represent Mr. Addison in this phase of the proceeding, the judicial counsel adopted eligibility guidelines and performance standards for capital post-conviction representation. And that is the other handout that I passed out. It's 7 pages long, and I think it gives you a very good overview of the experience that is necessary to represent an individual in a case like this. The counsel received only 2 written proposals for this representation, neither of which were from New Hampshire attorneys, and it's my understanding that nobody in the state of New Hampshire had the necessary experience to provide this level of representation. The specifics of the cost for the Hague representation are under seal by court order, so I cannot go into the specifics, but I can tell you that for phase one, the budget is $280,000. New Hampshire's use of the death penalty obliges the government to ensure that capital defendants and post-conviction proceedings have access to able and experienced counsel in order to protect their rights and legal interests in an arena that is widely recognized as legally complex and factually intensive. Although the Public Defender's Office has the expertise to handle these cases, capital representation is not included in our contract with that office. It would require a separate appropriation. If there were a conflict, then the public defender would not be able to take the case. The case would have to go to assigned counsel. Assigned counsel right now is paid on an hourly basis. For an underlying crime like this, the cost would likely be $100 to $125 an hour, and in capital proceedings, defendants are entitled to 2 attorneys. So although the costs to the public defender were significant, if this were to go to an assigned counsel, the cost would be substantially more. I'm happy to take any questions. And
what was the cost to take Michael Briggs, Officer Briggs' life?
I don't have an answer for that, Representative, and I'm not advocating one way or the other. I'm just informing you of what the costs for this type of defense representation are. My predecessor, Nina Gardner, explained the Judicial Council's role as the caboose of the criminal justice train, and I think it was a very apt description. We may not be what first comes to mind, but because of the constitutional requirements, our representation, the representation of the defendant, has to be funded.
Further question?
Cost on both.
Representative, I'm sorry, I don't have a comment to that.
I guess there's no more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care for your written testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, call Patrick Kitchen.
Good afternoon. I'm the chair of the New Hampshire Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. I'm also a former homicide prosecutor and a former homicide defense attorney. And during my career, I've probably handled well over 100 homicide cases. There are three things I'd like to touch upon today. The first is with respect to this bill itself. For those of you who are sitting on this panel thinking, just worried about what could happen to children, could they be abducted, could they be kidnapped and killed? This woman who talked about her friend's son being sexually assaulted and murdered, those crimes are already covered in the capital murder statute in this state. If you kidnap a person, including a child, and during the course of that kidnapping, you kill them, you are subject to the death penalty. If you kill an adult or a child during the course of a sexual assault, you are already subject to the death penalty in this state by statute. So there's no reason to amend the statute for those kinds of worst-case scenario crimes that we might think about. I agree with Sarah Blodgett's description of every child murder as being heartbreaking. And during my career, I handled many deaths that involve children, and they are heartbreaking. It's because they are different than adult deaths. It is a loss of innocence. It's a loss of the future. But I agree with the pediatrician that, in my experience, very few of those deaths are deliberate. Most of them have been, unfortunately, committed by parents or caretakers that were either overwhelmed or disturbed. I'll just mention three of the cases that I handled very briefly. One of them was a mother who killed three children. And she was found to be not guilty by reason of insanity. Actually, the state conceded that she was not guilty by reason of insanity. She went to the New Hampshire State Hospital, not the New Hampshire State Hospital, the secure psychiatric unit. A second one was also a mother that killed a child, threw him off the bridge in Manchester. And she was also, the state agreed, was not guilty by reason of insanity, went to the secure psychiatric unit. And a third, very briefly, was a man that killed his two children, and that was a deliberate act. He probably could have been charged with capital crime, but was not. But he killed himself while he was awaiting trial in Merrimack County Superior Court while we were looking into his mental state. To think that you can deter people who are disturbed and overwhelmed by subjecting them to the death penalty is wishful thinking. You can't deter people. You can't prevent deaths from overwhelmed people. And the third thing I want to say very, very quickly is that the more that you have people that are subject to the death penalty, the more it is possible to make mistakes that cannot be corrected. I remember Chief Justice Broderick testifying and saying that no sentence, and he testified against expansion of the death penalty, he actually was testifying for repeal, and he said that no sentence should ever have an eraser because mistakes can be made. And I'll tell you very briefly of a case that I was involved in several years ago that did involve the rape and smothering of a 7-year-old child, Elizabeth Knapp. She was found dead in her bed one morning. The police were called. They found that she had been smothered, that she had been raped. It was obvious to the police, it was obvious to me when I was asked to represent the person who was accused of killing him, it was obvious to the Attorney General who was assigned to the case, that it had to be, the perpetrator had to be the mother's live-in boyfriend. And it was obvious because this child was killed in her bed. She was killed in her bed right next to her sleeping sister. And the house itself, I have to tell you, was essentially, it was filled with trash. The entire floor was covered with toys, with ashtrays, with bric-brac. It would have been impossible, anyone would think, it would have been impossible for someone else to come into that house and to have raped and killed this child. It had to be Richard Buchanan, who was sleeping in the next door. It had to be him. As his lawyer, I thought it had to be him. Well, it turns out that Richard Buchanan was not the perpetrator of that crime, and the reason that we know that is because the actual perpetrator, a man by the name of James Dale, who raped this little girl, didn't wear a condom. And so he left semen that could be analyzed by DNA in this little girl's body. And therefore, we were able to essentially exonerate Richard Buchanan. And I know that Richard Buchanan, that there was pressure on the Attorney General to charge Richard Buchanan with capital murder. It fit the definition. It was death of a person in the course of a sexual assault. And it was a little girl. There were a lot of emotional reasons to charge Richard Buchanan with capital murder. It seemed like a slam dunk case for the state. If James Dale had worn a condom, as I sit here today, I feel virtually certain that Richard Buchanan would have been found guilty and would likely have been sentenced to death. But for the fact that this man didn't wear a condom, that's what saved his life. So mistakes happen, and they happen in the criminal justice system, and it's important to be cognizant of that when you think about expanding the death penalty in this state. Thank you.
They become insane, in other words, should they be retried for that murder if they were the person that possibly did it, or not?
No, because at the time of the, it goes back to the time of the incident itself. I will say that most people who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity, especially when it involves a homicide, spend an awful long time being treated at the secure psychiatric unit. And very briefly, what happens is that they are entitled to a hearing once every 5 years. A review to determine what is their mental state now, what is their capacity now, and are they able to reintegrate into society safely. I think that both of those women have actually been released from the secure psychiatric unit, but it took decades.
So they could be released.
They can.
At some point.
Yes.
Thank you. No, that's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
And the criminal, James Dale, what did he get for a sentence?
I can't remember whether he was charged with first or second degree murder. I'm sorry, I don't remember, but I know it's a significant sentence that he's still appealing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, fellow legislators. For record, Representative Al Baldessaro, Rockingham County District 5, which is Londonderry. I was standing over. I came in actually to sign in on the bill until I looked at the list there, and I'm so shocked at all the signatures on there that would oppose something like this. New Hampshire has a history of being tough on crime. What type of message does this say that you come into New Hampshire, it's okay to kill a kid, don't worry about it. We'll put you in jail, we'll feed you, we'll clothe you for until you die. Maybe some bleeding heart down the road will want to give you early out and put you back in the street. We have an opportunity here right now to say enough is enough. Never mind with all the bleeding hearts, all that sign that there and opposes this bill. It's a shame. I wish it was for women. I wish it was about disabled. Anyone that commits murder should get the death penalty. I'm hoping that we have an opportunity here to do the right thing, send a strong message. You kill a kid, a young kid here that's defenseless, you kill somebody disabled, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's time to come out and be strong against this here and say enough is enough. Thank you. Yes, I have. I also heard because of our tough laws, the police in New Hampshire don't mess around. And I go up in Cambridge, Mass. That's all I ever heard when you go into New Hampshire.
Further questions?
Sure. Probably good policing. You know, our state troopers, they're doing a great job on the highways, I believe, you know, that are keeping control. People think twice about coming to New Hampshire. I can say that as somebody who grew up in Massachusetts. We thought twice about coming up here as young kids, going to the beach and drink our beer or whatever. We knew the cops didn't mess around in New Hampshire versus, you know, other beaches.
Further questions?
If it's working so well, why change it?
Because it's not. We still have other issues. We still have murders. We got a young kid that got killed. We have other people, okay, come in our state and commit murder. We need to send a strong message and say enough is enough. I can't wait until they put that guy to kill Officer Briggs to death. I wait for that day. I got a bullet, by the way. I don't see why not, because you want to know why? If you were familiar with the laws of the land, under U.S. Code 18 in the Constitution, firing squad is still in the law. So I don't see why not. Hang them. That's still in the law, too, by the way, on the books. Federal.
Wouldn't it be more appropriate to these diehard bleeding lovers if we were to execute somebody just to give them an overdose of fentanyl?
That's possible. We got people coming into our state. I think anyone that dies under an overdose, deal should be going, you know, for accessory to murder. You know, and yeah, I think enough is enough. Our young are dying in our state. And what are we doing? We're going to put them in jail there and feed them good steak and eggs and then give them TVs and all the comforts of home. I have one last note I forgot. I sat here and I listened to somebody for about 15 minutes talk about the dollar figure. Tell that to the parent that lost a child how much money did that child lose that could have made in their life? You know, when they threw out that $2,775,000 for a case. Thank you.
Now, one last question to the committee, that phrases like bleeding hearts should not be uttered.
Okay.
So, not a good thing to do. Some of us may be bleeding hearts, and you don't know it. Chair calls Gregory Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gregory Smith, and I'm currently a partner at a law firm here in Concord, but for over 11 years, I was a prosecutor in the New Hampshire Attorney General's office and responsible for scores of homicide cases, including some which would have been subject to the death penalty. I know you have a lot of people who'd like to speak, so I'd like to be as brief as possible. I heard Barbara Keshen's testimony, and I agree with everything that she said. The crimes that you face when you deal with homicide, not here when we think about it theoretically or generally, but when you actually have a case, when you have to go to the autopsy and deal with the actual case itself, they can be horrific crimes, they can be tragic, and they're sometimes heartbreaking. But what we have to do is make sure that we separate our efforts to try to do something about that from the questions about how we pursue justice. What needs to be considered, when, in my humble opinion, when you think about this, is how do we make sure that the criminal justice system delivers justice? It's not enough to know what crime was committed. You have to know who committed it and how it was committed, and you have to make sure that the penalty that's imposed is one which is just, which is fair, and properly is matched to the crime. This bill isn't a narrow bill. With all respect for the sponsor and their good intentions, I think there are unexpected consequences from an expansion like this, which is not narrow. The testimony you've heard makes it clear that there are lots of cases that could come within the simple terms of this bill. The death of someone under 18. You heard someone speak about a child left in a car. Someone went in, got distracted, didn't come back soon enough, and the child died. Do we really think that that's a death penalty case? Now, my objection to expanding this is really resting on two points. One is we have an effective criminal justice system. The reason that we do so well, I think, is that we have an honest, effective system. We've always enjoyed that. It's not because we've imposed more severe penalties. Other jurisdictions impose much more severe penalties than we do. But our crime rate, including our homicide rate, is low. We have a system that deals with the death of children in an imposing, when the perpetrator is identified, an appropriate penalty. The problem with the overuse of a death penalty here, applying it to what would be many cases, I think the bill says two, but I don't think that's an accurate depiction of what we're talking about. The sponsor apparently doesn't either, is that we know that the death penalty is not a deterrent. And we know that innocent people are convicted and sent to death row for years, sometimes executed. More often, somebody eventually figures out that they were, in fact, innocent. To me, as a former prosecutor who used to enforce these cases, and I did what was my responsibility to do, it is deeply troubling that we would put in place a system that can do that. We are not capable of doing this carefully enough. And when it's the ultimate penalty, as Justice Broderick said, then there is no way to correct the injustice if we've executed that person. That's just something, it seems to me, we should not participate in. The penalties are severe. Life without parole is a very harsh sentence to sit in a room for the rest of your life and realize you will never have a life, hour after hour after hour. And I think our justice system is appropriately now set to deal with these problems in the right way, and to expand this broadly into these people, many of whom will be parents, and ask prosecutors whether they're going to bring the death penalty against some of them and not others, when the emotion will be as high as it is in this room about how we struggle with these kinds of cases, the pressure to find somebody and to name them and to prosecute them, as Barbara said, is high in all of these cases, and we know for a fact that in too many cases they get the wrong person. That's not justice, and that doesn't serve the purpose you seek to achieve by a bill like this. So I would respectfully recommend that you not pass a bill like this to try to deal with that problem. Reasonable differences in homicides, what?
Are you aware of regional differences in
regional
of homicides that occur?
Yes. The types of homicides and the number?
Yes.
I think the numbers are highest in places that have the death penalty. It's just the opposite. We, you know, they oppose it quite regularly. I think the death penalty is imposed in something like five, primarily in five counties in the United States, and they have a high crime rate, not a low crime rate. There's plenty of studies that demonstrate that the death penalty, because it doesn't come into the calculations of someone who is engaging in the conduct leading to the death at that time, does not an effective deterrent, as though we might all wish it were. It's not. I prosecuted cases where people got life without parole. That was over 35 years ago. They're still in prison. There are no people that I know of who have received the penalty of life without parole in New Hampshire who have been released.
Are there any cases of people on death row with the exception of Addison?
No. There was another capital punishment case that was brought against a businessman who plotted killing someone, and he was given life without parole. And I don't believe that anyone, despite the fact we've had the death penalty on our books for most of the time since, no one has been executed since 1939 in New Hampshire.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I apologize, Representative. But you are a co-sponsor of this bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Robert Dunham. I'm the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. We're a nonprofit organization in Washington that conducts research and publishes reports on issues relating to capital punishment. I'm a lawyer with two decades of experience litigating capital cases. And I served as an adjunct professor at Villanova University teaching death penalty law for 11 years before I became the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center 2 years ago. The Death Penalty Information Center doesn't take a position on the death penalty itself. We provide information, and I'd be happy to provide whatever assistance to members of the committee that you'd like. I'd like to start by putting this the bill in a kind of national context. Where we stand with the death penalty, where we're going. I'm not going to go through my entire written submissions because that would take forever. I will try to be short. We're in the midst nationally of a sea change in the public's view of capital punishment. Death penalty use fell historic lows last year, fewest number of death sentences imposed, lowest number of executions in 40 years, and public support for the death penalty is measured in public opinion polls. At a 40-year low. And to give you a quick picture of the decline, there were 30 death sentences imposed last year, and in 1996 there were 315, which meant that for every one death sentence imposed last year, there had been 10 and a half 20 years ago. That suggests a major shift in the way the United States is thinking about the death penalty. And at a time when most of the country is moving away from capital punishment, and most of the country is moving towards pursuing it less frequently, the expansion of the death penalty, efforts to expand the death penalty, are increasingly rare. And this bill would be a step away from where the country appears to be moving. Now, we've heard earlier from the proponents of the bill that it is a narrow expansion. I think that's not the case. Although the language at the top of the bill describes it as an act making a person who knowingly causes death of a child guilty of capital murder, the language of the bill itself refers to victims of murder who are age 18 or less. I spent the weekend poring over data from the FBI criminal from the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the Uniform Crime Information from the FBI. The estimate was that between the 1990s and 2008, 10% of the murders in the United States involved victims who were under age 18. And if you look at the numbers from the last 5 years, we're talking about 9%. This is not a narrow expansion. It would, based on the national figures, make 10% or 9% of all homicides, death eligible, in New Hampshire. And another point to note is that there are states who do have an age of victim aggravating circumstance. But if this bill is enacted, New Hampshire would have the broadest of all of them. There is no other state in the United States that provides for race of victim aggravating circumstance or race of victim eligibility for the death penalty that sets the age as high as this bill does. Now, apart from the fact that the bill doesn't narrowly expand, it significantly expands the death penalty, it also creates a heightened risk of error. And we've heard some of the reasons why already. Because of the highly emotional nature of child killing cases, the same thing that makes the crime so horrifying makes the crime more susceptible to a wrongful outcome. The highly emotional nature makes it so that witnesses give more emotional testimony as opposed to more factual testimony. It makes it so that police and prosecutors, once they focus on a potential suspect, become more narrow in their focus and have more of a tunnel vision. It makes it so that we have this somebody has to be punished state of mind. And this is the same, the stakes are increased, and for the prosecutor, the rewards are also increased. And that creates both conscious and unconscious biases. For informants, with the rewards being greater, it gives them a greater incentive to provide false information. And the same is true for expert witnesses. The emotional nature of it often causes them to reach results that simply are not the case. And we have seen in case after case, and I provided examples of it in my written testimony, I won't go into all of them today, that a disproportionate number of junk science cases involve child victims, and people have been sentenced to death, and in at least one case we know about, executed for the death of a child that was not even a crime. One of the nation's most famous death row exonerations and its most infamous exoneration involved deaths of children. I think many of you know Kirk Bloodsworth. He has come here to testify about the death penalty on a number of occasions. And Kirk Bloodsworth is a very decent, very law-abiding, honest man who looks incredibly physically imposing. And in the 1980s, he was down on his luck. At that time, a young girl was brutally raped and murdered. There were two children who saw somebody on a hill with the sunlight behind them, did not get a good look. But after interrogation, they came to give a description that was pretty close to what Kirk looked like. And the prosecution focused on him. In his case, the false eyewitness testimony and the fact the prosecution withheld some exculpatory evidence led to this innocent man being convicted and sentenced to death. And even after his trial was overturned because the prosecutorial misconduct had been exposed, he was tried again and convicted again. It took another 5 or 6 years before DNA finally exonerated him and he was freed. Cameron Todd Willingham is perhaps the most famous innocent person to be executed in the United States. He was executed for the death of his children. He lost his children in a house fire. And junk science said that it was arson. The arson experts used the science as it was known at the time. They were not trying to frame an innocent man. But they gave false testimony. And on that false testimony, he was sentenced to death and he was executed. I represented in my 20 years of capital defense work several innocent people who were on death row for the deaths of children. I have seen in those cases that there has been extensive prosecutorial misconduct. There has been extensive use of prison informants who were incentivized because they knew they could get benefits for providing information in an important case. And in several of the cases, that information was withheld from the defense. So there are incentives to cheat and to just direct the case towards an ultimate conviction and death sentence. It's worse in these kinds of cases. And I think that the expansion carrying with it an increased risk of error in these emotional cases is something that this committee should take very, very seriously when it decides what it wants to do. I'm not going to go into all the cases. I make reference to where you can find information about them. I'm happy to talk with the committee members about that. But there are a couple of little things that I wanted to mention that other people had alluded to already. The people who are most likely to be falsely convicted or overcharged and sentenced to death in these cases tend to be more vulnerable defendants. We're talking about parents who have significant disabilities themselves, significant problems with raising kids, significant brain impairments or emotional disorders. We've heard from several other witnesses about how much of the time the killings are not intentional. But when a death penalty is on the table, there is an incentive for the partner in the case to try to protect his or her interests. And we've seen in a number of cases across the country that that is done by providing false information about the other partner so that the blame can be cast elsewhere. It results in both over-convictions, convictions for first-degree murder when it should be a lesser charge, and it results in wrongful capital convictions as well. In closing, I'd just like to say that at a time when the death penalty is being used less frequently, this bill is a step in the other direction. It's not clear how the expansion would cost-effectively serve the public good. It would make perhaps 10% of murders capitally eligible. There's no evidence that the death penalty would deter these murders. There's no evidence that it would be more of a deterrent than life without parole. And there's an elevated risk of wrongful conviction and wrongful execution. This committee has a lot to think about, but I think there are serious questions as to whether this bill is the way to go. I'd like to say one other thing based on a question that someone raised earlier about minors killing minors and could that occur. The United States Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, says the death penalty cannot be applied against individuals who are under age 18 at the time of the offense. There was one comment made by the proponent of the bill that this would give another quiver in the arsenal for prosecutors to get guilty pleas that could save the state money. All of the studies that have been done of costs across the country have shown that that's a false notion, that it actually costs more to charge somebody capitally and have that case result in a disposition by plea than it does to charge the case non-capitally and have it go to trial. There are a lot of reasons why, and it would take a lot of time, and I won't get into that here, but if you would like more information about that or anything else relating to the death penalty, we at the Death Penalty Information Center would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Okay. Other questions?
Have you heard of Operation Innocence?
I have not.
Northwest University?
Oh, yes, the Innocence, yes.
Has your findings resulted in any governors that you can recall that commuted death penalties in your state?
Yes. In Illinois, there were major commutations. Governor Ryan cleared the row. We actually have a page on the website that lists all of the death penalty commutations in the modern era.
As best as you can recollect from Illinois, was the number over 100?
Yeah, it was.
That's Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's 3 o'clock, and we have another bill scheduled that was scheduled for 2:30. And everybody here wants to speak for 5 minutes. Take another half an hour or more, minus the questions of the committee. So I guess what I'm asking is, we can continue this hearing if people don't feel as though they're obligated to fulfill 5 minutes. Sabrina Butler. Can you do it in less than 5 minutes?
I can.
All right.
Hello, everyone. Thank you guys for having me and listening to me anyway. My name is Sabrina Bowler. I was 17 when I was sentenced to die by lethal injection for a crime that I didn't commit. My son died from heart problems, kidney problems, and chronic bowel syndrome. I didn't have the right representation to start with. I ended up with two sets of attorneys who found that out. The district attorney withheld that. He took the jury to a picnic while they were supposed to be sequestered. I'm from the state of Mississippi. When I was sentenced to die, no one told me that the state had to exhaust all state remedies before they could actually carry out a death sentence. So I sat on death row 2 years, 9 months, waiting to die. My sentence was overturned. When my sentence was overturned, they found out that what I told you, my son had heart problems, kidney problems, and chronic bowel syndrome. My daughter's 14 today, has the same disease that we're currently fighting. And I'm here to oppose that because the system doesn't work for everybody. It made a mistake. And if it hadn't been for an attorney that wanted to take the chance on trying to take my case, I would be dead today. And I think that you guys should really look at the death penalty as a whole, the way it is imposed, and the people that it's imposed on. I was poor, black, didn't have the money for the right representation. That is the reason why I feel like I didn't get the right representation in court. And I wish that you guys would just really look at this before you guys decide to put people to death, because 170-something of us, already innocent people, that they've made the mistake. That should say something for itself. Everybody is not murderers. I'm not a murderer. I didn't kill my son. And I'm still doing that today, trying to prove throughout my life that the capital punishment, the death penalty, is not working.
Thank you very much.
I will be as fast as I can. I'm Margaret Hawthorne. I live in Ringe. I'm the mother of Molly McDougall, who was murdered in Henniker in 2010. Molly was just 2 weeks from graduating from NHTI in nursing. She wanted to become an operating room nurse. New Hampshire lost a good and responsible citizen that day. Now, our daughter was happily married. She was living with her husband on a family farm. I don't have a photo of her with me, but I can tell you she was very, very attractive. And that, in fact, was her undoing, because she found herself, even though she was married, declining the unwanted advances of a man who took a fancy to her. And for that, he shot her in the face, less than a week from the day he met her. She was unarmed, alone, in her own home, studying for final exams. Molly, like a lot of victims, was as defenseless against this murderer's bullet as a 2-year-old. Now, I admit, I opposed the death penalty before Molly died. I continued to oppose it in the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of her death, and I still oppose it. But I'm going to leave, enough other people have talked about reasons for opposing the death penalty. I want to speak about how I feel this particular bill affecting me as a murder victim's family member. So New Hampshire stepped on a slippery slope in 2008 when Michael Addison became the first person in nearly 50 years to be sentenced to death in the, here. And at that point, discussion about the death penalty grew livelier in circles around the state. It was no longer old history, you know, something that had sort of faded into had been abandoned half a century earlier. At the time, the state had fairly tight parameters around its death penalty. But in 2011, that criteria expanded to include murder committed during a home invasion. Molly's death had involved a home invasion, and had the expansion passed a little more than a year earlier, hers could have been considered a capital murder case. I was relieved that that wasn't even in the equation. So now HB 351 seeks to expand the parameters again. And, it, you know, we've heard, this is a really emotionally charged topic. You know, who isn't outraged, appalled, and disgusted by the thought of the murder of a child? So it's not easy to speak to a bill that, you know, I trust is intended to make children safer. And if I believed it would accomplish that, I don't know if I could be testifying today. But the evidence doesn't show that it will do anything to protect children. And there are problems with this bill. For one thing, it sets murder victims' families apart from one another by placing, in a bizarre way, higher value on one life than another. And I'll tell you, the murder victims' family members' community is one that nobody wants to join, and we don't want to see you join it. But we count on each other to support one another. We can provide comfort in ways that no one else really can, because no one else has been there. So it troubles me to see something that does potentially separate us from one another. I've asked myself whether our daughter's death has been any less devastating for me because she was 31 instead of, say, 11. Now, since January, I've spent every day with my husband, who's a lung at his bedside. He's a lung transplant at Brigham and Women's. And in that time, I've seen an extraordinary community of healthcare professionals at work. A lot of them are nurses, dedicating their skills, their intelligence, their training, and their compassion to helping very sick people get well. Each day that I spend at the hospital, I struggle with fresh grief as I imagine the nurse that Molly could have been. Her death at 31 remains as devastating to me, I believe, as it would have been had it happened 20 years earlier. You know, I don't think there's ever an acceptable time to lose someone you have birthed, loved, and nurtured. When we lose an adult child, we have had the gift of added years to be in relationship. We've had added years to watch the story of a cherished life unfold. But there's never enough of it. There simply isn't a time when that loved one's life begins to diminish in value, which is what this bill says. You know, of course, my heart goes out to any family whose child is murdered. I feel the same revulsion that anyone else does at such a violation of all that is right and good. And I want nothing to stand in the way of my instinct for compassion. I have a friend who's also a family member of a murder victim, and he puts it well. Each victim's family experiences their loved one's death as the most heinous thing to them. The pain cuts so deeply, it's hard to put a perspective on whether someone else's loss is worse than one's own. So the slope is already slippery. The state enters a grisly business in deciding whom to kill. It examines the circumstances of the crime itself, we know that, looks at things like premeditation to determine whether there are grounds for applying the death penalty. That's complex enough without taking a position on whose life is more precious. If the criteria is age, profession, or other characteristic of the victim, then a greater premium is placed on one life than another, whether or not intentionally. In effect, it says the murder of this person is more heinous than the murder of that one, based on who these two individuals were. And as has been mentioned, I'm troubled by the idea that the life of an 18-year-old is worth less than the life of a 17-year-old, even though that might be one day's difference. And I'm offended by a system that places greater value on the life of a police officer or a judge than on the life of a nurse or a teacher. Now, I don't want that remedy by adding nurses and teachers' lives to the criteria, you know, and then social workers and then and then and then. I want the state to climb off this slope and, or at least put some crampons on and stop the slide. Thank you. Oh, I don't know if there are questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Bill McGonigal. You also put down 5 minutes.
Yeah, it won't be more than 50. Afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill McGonigal, and I reside in Bow, New Hampshire. And I'm here to provide testimony against passage of HB 351 FM. Many of you may know me as the previous assistant commissioner for the Department of Corrections. I retired from that position late in August of 2014. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm opposed to the death penalty in all cases, not just the circumstances set forth in this bill. My reasons for this opposition are many, but they start with a fundamental belief that killing persons in the name of the state is just wrong. After that, my rationale encompasses a number of things: the possibility of wrongful conviction and execution, lack of any evidence of a deterrent effect, cost, and the fact that many executions by lethal injection in other states have gone terribly awry due to the inability to obtain the proper chemicals. But in the end, I always return to the fact that I believe it to be wrong. You've heard testimony this afternoon against the specifics of this bill. I'm here to talk particularly about the impact of the death penalty on the staff from the Department of Corrections. RSA 350:5, Section 15, Procedure in Capital Murder states, quote, "An execution carried out by lethal injection shall be performed by a person selected by the commissioner of the Department of Corrections and trained to administer the injection." The fact is that it will take a team of DOC personnel to carry out the sentence. Some of the personnel and tasks involve personnel to go to the condemned person's cell and strap him or her to a specially designed gurney, kicking and screaming most likely. Personnel to transport that gurney and the condemned from the cell to the actual site of the execution. Personnel to place the IV into the condemned person's vein, assuring that the IV is correctly sited, that it is in the vein correctly, hasn't passed through it or around it into the surrounding tissue. Personnel to place the IV correctly despite the often poor quality of the veins of the condemned, often due to chronic drug or alcohol abuse or just poor lifestyle for years. Personnel to activate the injection of the separate chemicals at the appropriate time and in the prescribed sequence. Personnel to evaluate the effectiveness of the sedative chemical by observing observation of the condemned person's state of awareness. We wouldn't want to kill somebody that didn't know, that knew they were being killed. That was sort of an ironic comment. Personnel to escort the three distinct groups of persons to attend the execution: members of the victim's family, members of the condemned person's family, and members of the public, including selected media, and personnel to assure that these groups are kept totally separate and to monitor their behavior. I'm sure there are others that I have, other tasks that I have failed to mention, but those were the ones that came to mind. Personnel of the Department of Corrections have never been required to carry out, nor have they been trained to perform these tasks. In past hearings, we have heard veterans of executions in other states speak of the impact emotionally and physically on themselves and others placed on execution teams. These impacts include inability to sleep, nightmares, flashbacks, abuse of alcohol and other substances, and often an inability to ever return to work again. Sounds like PTSD to me. It hasn't mattered whether these personnel were proponents of the death penalty prior to the execution or not. These things still accrue to them. The state of New Hampshire, by the fact of having passed statute authorizing the use of the death penalty, is requiring the personnel of the Department of Corrections to kill another human being in the name of the state. Along with my objections to the death penalty in general, I fear for the impact it will undoubtedly have on the lives and careers of those asked to carry out the execution. Thank you. What's that?
Would you give them their testimony?
It's already been provided.
Yeah. Sir, do you remember the time when I previously had on the house bill for a SWAT, for a firing squad?
Excuse me?
Do you remember in my previous terms when I sponsored a house bill for a firing squad?
No, I'm sorry.
Easily forgettable.
Thank you.
Sam Lively, can you do it quicker than 5 minutes?
I will certainly try.
Thank you.
It is true that the murder of a child is very serious and saddens their family and friends. However, it is impossible to avoid a wrongful conviction in all cases where history shows that over the years many people have been wrongfully convicted and in capital cases have been executed before additional evidence that cleared them has showed up. Maine abolished capital punishment for this reason many years ago. I would ask the people that support this and have had the tragedy of losing members of their family to a violent act. It's understandable that they feel very sad about losing the members of their family, but how would they feel if the convicted person was actually innocent and was a member of their family? Also, capital punishment has one thing in it that it hasn't been mentioned here yet today, and that is the fact that capital punishment itself can be and has been the motive of a murder. California has had at least two such cases where somebody wanted to commit suicide, didn't have the guts to do it themselves, so they went out and killed somebody else and then basically surrendered themselves to be charged with a capital crime. I would suggest, ladies and gentlemen, where we're short of time today, that you consider holding this bill for interim study till next session. If you do so, you have my phone number. I've got a fair amount of written information and several books on the subject at home. I'd be happy to loan to you, and I would be happy to work with you in looking at it between sessions. Any questions?
It's kind of interesting that you indicated that we should hold a bill, because that is exactly what I want to hopefully convince the committee to do. But the reason for that is if there's a Senate bill coming over, it's the same thing. So.
Well, when you get the Senate bill, you should consider looking at both of them between sessions.
Yeah, maybe we will. Thank you very much. Chris Warren.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'll be very quick. And I have written testimony that covers material I won't give you in my verbal testimony. I'd like to point a case that could have been a huge miscarriage of justice. It already was. A white woman was raped in Central Park, and five black boys had confessed within 24 hours. If she had died, they probably would have been executed. all five broke under psychological pressure that lasted all night. And our president says they were still says they were killed.
Chris, are you talking about the Central Park Five?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that,